Well, good morning, everyone. Hope you've had a great week this week. I guess school starts in a couple of weeks. I can't really figure that out, why school starts now in August. You know, it used to start after Labor Day, and now it's like kids have no summer at all. Some of you young parents probably are glad about that, but I don't know. Well, we're continuing our series this morning, which is called Revive, Summer of Blessing and Growth. And we are in the second half of our series where we're beginning to talk about some of the spiritual practices that will help us grow in our faith. And I want to start today by just telling you a little bit about sort of one of my heroes. His name is Blaise Pascal. And Pascal was a Frenchman who lived in the mid-1600s. He actually died at the age of 39. But before he died, he made huge contributions in the area of mathematics and physics. He was a brilliant man. He was a child prodigy, actually. Some of his best work and most important discoveries as a scientist actually were made while he was a teenager. But as a young adult, he had an encounter with God. And his interest sort of moved in the direction of philosophy and theology. And not long before he died, he wrote a very significant book kind of filled with his sort of random thoughts and meditations on these things, and it was called Pensée. The book is mostly a mathematician's case for believing in God. But in that book, he also shared some very lucid thoughts on psychology before psychology was even a valid discipline. And one of his most interesting statements sums up sort of the core of his thinking. And here is what he said. He said, all of humanity's problems stem from man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. Isn't that interesting? All of humanity's problems stem from a man's inability to sit quietly in a room alone. According to Pascal, we fear the silence of existence, and instead we choose distraction, running from our problems, into what he called false comforts. And the root issue is we never learn the art and the practice of solitude. You know, if you consider today's world, Pascal was a prophet. If there's one word to describe the direction of the last 100 years, it's connectedness, right? Think about it. From the telephone, to the radio, to the TV, to the internet, to that smartphone you have in your pocket right now. We found ways to stay constantly connected all the time. Lynn and I, we can stand in our kitchen today and we can not just talk to our grandkids who live in Kentucky, but we can actually see them on a screen as well. And there are many benefits like that to all this connectedness. But the one thing we often sacrifice is solitude. Solitude. A contemporary writer named Zat Rana puts it this way. He said, we now live in a world where we're connected to everything except ourselves. In today's world, people can go their whole lives without truly digging beyond the surface level masks they wear. In fact, many do. We are increasingly out of touch with who we are. And that is a problem. I would take it one step further and say that this constant connectivity means that we're not only out of touch with ourselves, but we're out of touch with God. We're out of touch with God. Not only do we need to learn to sit quietly alone in a room, we need to learn to sit quietly alone in a room with God. With God. The word for this is solitude. I believe we all need solitude. I believe deep down we all long for solitude. And maybe one of the reasons it's hard for us is we associate solitude with loneliness. And they are two very different things. Solitude isn't just being alone. It's letting our aloneness and even our loneliness lead us into something different, which is solitude. One of my favorite writers, Henry Nouwen, put it this way. Loneliness is painful. Solitude is peaceful. Loneliness makes us cling to others in desperation. Solitude allows us to respect others in their uniqueness and create community. The longing for solitude is the longing for God, to know Him, to connect with Him, to encounter Him. I think it's helpful to think of solitude as a space. Solitude is a space in time set apart for God and for God alone. A time when we unplug, a time when we withdraw from people, from tasks, from distractions. Solitude is also a physical place where we meet with God, a place not cluttered with work and technology and even people. And then finally, solitude is a space within ourselves where God's Spirit and our spirit dwell together in union. It's that place within me that is reserved for intimacies between just me and God. Solitude and silence often go hand in hand. Silence can deepen our experience of solitude because it creates a space for listening to God and for listening to what's really going on in our own soul. It's almost like solitude and silence allow our true soul to come out of hiding and encounter the one who loves us like none other. I love how Parker Palmer writes this. He says, our soul is like a wild animal. If we want to see a wild animal, we know that the last thing we should do is go crashing through the woods, yelling for it to come out. But if we will walk quietly into the woods, sit patiently by the base of the tree, and fade into our surroundings, the wild animal we seek might put in an appearance. Isn't that a great image? Silence and solitude are nurtured by just one more thing, and that's what I would call slowing. Slowing. Someone once asked Dallas Willard, what is the most important thing I should do to remain spiritually healthy? Willard paused for a long time, and then he said this. He said, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. That's what he said. And the guy was surprised. But he wrote it down, and then he looked up, and he said, that's a good one, Dallas. What's next? And Willard said, that's it. There's nothing else. Ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your lives. Think about how that would have changed just this past week in our lives. Hurried people rarely rub shoulders with solitude. There are too many things to do, too many people to see, too many places to go. Now, I realize that what I am talking about here for many people seems like totally unrealistic. Maybe you're a young mother and you have three little kids and you're thinking, yeah, I'd love some solitude. But how is that possible? They're up at the crack of dawn, and by the time they go to bed, by the time they're bathed and in bed, you know, I'm too exhausted to even think. Or maybe you're an extrovert, and you love being with people, and the idea of spending 30 minutes alone in silence sounds like purgatory to you. So in light of that, it's important to say that this may look different for different people, and it may look different at different seasons in your life, but somehow all of us need solitude, and we need to learn to nourish that in our life. Now, there are so many different examples of this in the Bible. I could go on and on, but I would believe, and I'm sure you would agree, that the best example of this is Jesus. No one had as many demands upon his life as Jesus. No one had as much urgent work to do but Jesus. Yet Jesus still found time for solitude, and somehow Jesus never seemed rushed. He never seemed stressed out. And so if you have a Bible, turn with me to the Gospel of Mark, chapter 1. We'll have the words up on the screen if you need them. But let me give you the setting here. The setting here is Jesus' public ministry has just begun. And of all the gospel writers, Mark portrays Jesus as constantly on the move, whereas the other gospel writers portray Jesus as a teacher, Mark emphasizes him as a man of action. In fact, Mark's favorite word in his gospel is the word immediately. He was constantly saying, immediately Jesus did this or that. That's his favorite word. And that word is actually used several times here in chapter 1, verses 21 to 34. But these verses describe a very full and demanding day for Jesus in Capernaum. He began in the synagogue where he first taught, and then he cast out a demon, and then he went to Simon Peter's home, perhaps hoping to get some rest. Immediately, he's confronted with another crisis. Peter's mother-in-law is sick with a fever. So after Jesus learns of this, he goes in and he heals her. But that still wasn't the end of his day. Look at verse 32. That evening, after sunset, the people brought to Jesus all the sick and demon-possessed. The whole town gathered at the door, and Jesus healed many who had various diseases. He also drove out many demons, but he would not let the demons speak because they knew who he was. So the whole town gathers at Simon Peter's door, and Jesus spends the evening healing and casting out demons. This is what you would call a very busy day. This is what you'd call a grind of a day. And there were days like that for Jesus, hectic days, full days, demanding days, exhausting days. And you and I, let's face it, we have days like that as well. This is real life. And sometimes, let's face it, the things that we have to do aren't nearly as spiritually significant as what Jesus is doing here. Diapers need to be changed. Cars need to be serviced. Bills need to be paid. Business trips need to be taken. Kids need to be taken to soccer practice. It all sounds very unimportant, but that's real life, particularly in this fast-paced place where we live. And Jesus gets it. Jesus had a lot on his plate. Would you agree? So do we. But the thing about Jesus is, as I read the gospel accounts, he never seemed hurried. He never seemed frantic or compulsive in his need to get things done. There always seemed to be this sense of intentionality and calm about him. And so I would just ask the question, what was his secret? How did he pull that off? Well, I think the answer lies in what we see Jesus doing next. Let's look at verse 35. Very early in the morning, while it was still dark, Jesus got up, left the house, and went off to a solitary place where he prayed. Simon and his companions went to look for him. And when they found him, they exclaimed, "Everyone is looking for you." Jesus replied, "Let us go somewhere else, to the nearby villages, so I can preach there also. That is why I have come." When it says very early in the morning, Mark uses a phrase that literally means the last watch of the night. So it would have been between 4 and 6 a.m. And he says that Jesus went out to a solitary place, which literally means an abandoned place. It means perhaps even a place in the wilderness. And when it says he prayed, Mark uses a verb tense that indicates he prayed continually. So he was praying throughout that time. And this is something Jesus made a habit of doing. If you just flip over a few pages to Mark chapter 6, you'll see that when his disciples return from a busy day of ministry with their adrenaline pumping, it says this, starting in verse 30, it says, "The apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they'd done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going, they didn't even have a chance to eat. He said to them, 'Come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some," what?
Rest.
So what is that but an invitation to slow down? An invitation to slow down. This comes out in the other gospels as well. After reporting that John the Baptist was murdered by King Herod, Matthew, the gospel writer, says this: "When Jesus heard what had happened, he withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place." And then you go over to Luke's gospel, and you see this repeatedly. In Luke chapter 5, it says, "News about Jesus spread all the more, so that crowds of people came to hear him and be healed of their sicknesses." Again, a very busy time, but Jesus often withdrew to lonely places and prayed. It appears this was our Lord's habit. retreating from the crowds to be alone with his father. You see the same thing in Luke chapter 6, right before Jesus chose the 12 as his apostles. It says, one of those days, Jesus went out to a mountainside to pray and spent the night praying to God. Literally, it says he went to the mountain, as if this was a specific place that Jesus often went. And then later in Luke chapter 9, Jesus goes to the same mountain. It says about 8 days after Jesus said this, he took Peter, John, and James with him and went up onto a mountain to pray. Sometimes this is called the Mount of Transfiguration because it was there that Jesus was transfigured and he spoke with Moses and Elijah. Many believe this so-called mountain was the Mount of Olives, which by our standards really is not a mountain. It's really just kind of a hill. But this would have been the place where Jesus went on the night of his betrayal as well. Remember where he poured his heart out to his father, and he was so distraught, he sweat drops of blood. It's no wonder that Judas brought the authorities there to that place to arrest Jesus, because he knew that's where Jesus usually went to be alone. And Judas knew that, and he knew he'd find Jesus there. So, it's quite clear from these glimpses into Jesus' life that he practiced solitude. He intentionally took times of slowing. And it's very interesting to me that he often did that when the demands upon him and the urgency of those demands were the greatest. And we saw that in Mark chapter 1. I find this a rather funny story. So think again about Mark chapter 1, which I read to you a bit earlier. Simon Peter wakes up. Maybe he woke up early, I don't know. He looks around and he counts the sleeping bags and notices that one of them is empty, and it's Jesus. Oh my gosh. So he rouses the other 11, and in a panic, it's like, where's Jesus? Have you guys seen him? I can't believe he's not here. We've got work to do. We've got people lined up at the doorstep already. They have traveled far and wide to have their needs met by Jesus. Where is he? He's always doing this. So they go on a manhunt. By the way, literally the word that Mark uses for this is a manhunt. They hunted for him. And that word is always used in the Bible in a hostile sense. They hunted for him. A word always used in a hostile sense. And when they find Jesus, you see that come out, because what does Peter do? He rebukes him. Everyone is looking for you. In other words, what in the world are you doing out here now? We've got work to do, Jesus, important work. It's interesting, the last time Jesus was out in the desert, in the wilderness, he was tempted by Satan. Here, he's out in the wilderness, and he's tempted by Simon. A different kind of temptation. Yet Jesus says, no. No, Simon. Let's go somewhere else where I can preach. That's why I came. That's why the Father sent me. So notice something here. Simon Peter is controlled by the needs, Simon Peter is controlled by the needs and demands of those around him. It's like Soren Kierkegaard once said, he said, the press of busyness is like a charm. That's Peter. The press of busyness is like a charm, seeking to lay hold of ever younger victims so that we are scarcely allowed time for God to develop us in Christian character. That's Simon. But Jesus does not let the press of busyness charm him. Rather, Jesus is controlled by the will of God. And he discovered that in prayerful solitude. As we see here with Jesus, solitude will have a way of clarifying your purpose. Clarifying your purpose. Solitude is a way to step away from the tyranny of the urgent and see what God is really calling me to, what he really wants me to do. And sometimes the things we're stepping away from, as was the case with Jesus here, are very good and noble things. It's hard to say no to those things. But solitude is a place where we gain freedom from the pressures and expectations of other people and of our frenzied culture that try to mold us every single day. We all know about the frog in the kettle, right? You put the frog in a pot of boiling water and it will immediately hop out. Smart frog, right? But you put the frog in water at room temperature and you slowly turn up the heat and it will stay there until it is cooked to death. It's the same with us. The greatest dangers are not the sudden, dramatic ones. They're the ones that sneak up on us and are so much a part of our environment, we don't even notice them. You see, our culture, folks, is dominated by a worldview that is toxic. Did you know that? It's toxic. We are surrounded by values of money and success and beauty and security and love that are lethal. They're lethal. And unless we learn to withdraw, we may very well never realize we are getting cooked by them. And so this is why the Apostle Paul in Romans urged us, do not conform. Do not conform to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your minds. And solitude is a way of renewing our minds. Another thing that strikes me about the way Jesus practiced solitude is that he practiced it without legalism and without rigidity. Nowhere in the Gospels do you see Jesus telling his disciples that they must wake up every morning at 5:30 a.m. to pray and read their Bibles for at least 30 minutes. Never see that. Instead, Jesus' times of solitude come at a variety of moments, in a variety of situations. Often, they were occasioned by a particular need or a decision he had to make. Jesus did not meet with his Father out of a sense of legal obligation, but rather out of a personal need to be in God's presence without distraction. His time alone was not to appease God, not to earn brownie points with the Father. It wasn't some kind of rabbit's foot to go into his day with. As a young believer, I was extremely eager not just to know God, but to please God. And I learned early on from other Christians around me that spending time alone with God was an absolute requirement to grow as a Christian. And so I learned that it had to be done in the morning, because how could you start off your day without God? And the earlier you woke up, the better, because the more pain you experienced showed how more committed you were, right? And it also gave you more time. And of course, the more time you spent with God, the more spiritual you are. And I learned there were all kinds of things I was supposed to do in this time. I was to read my Bible. I was to pray, not just for my own needs, but for everyone else's, including all the missionaries overseas. And I was to keep a journal and write eloquently about all the things that God was doing in my life. And if I was really spiritual, this would be accompanied by fasting. And somehow in the midst of this, I became convinced that if I didn't do those things first thing in the morning, then my whole day would be doomed. Does that sound familiar to anybody at all? I finally realized all of this was just putting me in bondage. I had come out of bondage when I knew Christ, when I came to know Christ. Now I was back in bondage. Instead of drawing me closer to God, I felt more distant because I could never quite live up to the higher and higher standards. So for a while, I just gave up trying. I said, forget it. But somewhere along the line, I learned I still needed to spend time with him. And I longed for that, not to appease him, not to demonstrate my spirituality, but just because I longed to be with him. I needed him, and I loved him. And one of the things I learned was even my desire to be with him was a response to his gracious invitation to come to him. So I was responding to him when I came to him. I remember as a boy growing up in the Catholic Church and going into the confessional booth. And some of you will remember the very first thing you said when you went into the confessional booth. Remember, forgive me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been, and in my case, it had been a long time. It had been a year since my last confession. And that's what you said. You had to tell the Father how long it had been since your last confession. And the focus was immediately on me and my negligence in showing up to confession. So now, when I come to him, I don't do that. I don't come filled with guilt and shame, but I come with gratitude that he's drawing me near. He's initiating fellowship and intimacy with me. And the point is not to race through a series of activities, but simply to be with him, to pour my heart out to him, and to listen to him as the Spirit of God opens my heart to his word. I've learned that there is simplicity in solitude. Solitude is fundamentally a place of prayer, a place of responding to God's invitation to be present with him. Eugene Peterson, one of my favorite writers, tells a great story about when he was 5 years old, growing up on a farm. And he walked across a meadow between his backyard and a fenced field, and he watched a farmer who he knew, a man named Leonard Storm, a massive Norwegian man, plow the field with his tractor. And Eugene, as a little boy, always longed to get a ride on that John Deere tractor that Leonard Storm drove. One summer, Eugene was standing at the fence, and he was watching Leonard Storm plow the field. And he was about 100 yards away, and he spotted him. And when Mr. Storm spotted Eugene, he stopped the tractor, he stood up on the seat of the tractor, and he made strong waving motions to Eugene, big motions like this to Eugene with his arms. And Eugene had never seen anyone gesture like that. And the big Norwegian from so far away looked very mean and very angry. He was large and ominous with his overalls and his straw hat. And he was yelling as well. Storm was yelling, but the wind was blowing so hard, Eugene couldn't hear what he was saying. And Eugene knew that he was probably where he should not be. Five-year-old boys usually are, right? So he turned and he left. He didn't really think he'd done anything wrong. He just wanted to get a ride on the tractor, but he went home and he felt rebuked and he felt rejected. Eugene tells what happened not long after that. Listen to what he says. He says, "The Sunday after my disappointment at the edge of his field, Brother Storm," that's what they called him in church, "Brother Storm called me over after church and said, 'Little Pete,'" that's what he called him, "'Little Pete, why didn't you come out in the field Thursday and ride the tractor with me?' I told him I didn't know I could have, that I thought he was chasing me away. I said, 'I called you to come. I waited for you to come. Why did you leave?' I said, 'I didn't know that that was what he was doing.' He said, 'What do you do when you want somebody to come to you?' I showed him. I extended my index finger and curled it back towards me 3 or 4 times. He harumphed." That's what he says. He harumphed. I'm not sure what it means to harumph, but he harumphed. And the big Norwegian said, "That's piddling, little Pete. On the farm, we do things big." So I see that story as kind of a parable. We long to be with God, as Eugene longed to be on that tractor. But sometimes we see him rebuking us when in fact he's inviting us to come in a big way, to talk to him, to ride with him, to get to know him better. I mean, isn't that what the gospel is all about? I mean, think about it. When Jesus died on the cross, we are told that the veil or the curtain to the Holy of Holies was torn asunder, wasn't it? You ever thought about that? And the idea there is that through the work that Jesus did on the cross, through the blood of Jesus Christ, through the sacrifice of Jesus on your behalf, he now welcomes you into that place only the high priest could enter once a year on the Day of Atonement. He now welcomes you into the Holy of Holies. As the gospel writer of Hebrews says, "Therefore, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and the full assurance of faith." So let me encourage you this morning to ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. Let me encourage you to find a way to create space in your life for solitude and silence. Create space by setting time apart for God and for God alone. A time when you unplug and withdraw from people, from tasks, from distractions, and even from your phone. Create space by finding a physical place where you meet with God. Do you have a place you go? A place that works for you? A place like that mountain that Jesus often retreated to? A physical space not cluttered with work, noise, and technology, or even people. And then finally, create a space within your own self. Within your own self. That space where God's spirit and your spirit dwell together in union. That place reserved for the intimacies only you and God share. I can tell you one thing. Solitude will require a lifetime of perseverance, especially if you're not practiced in it. And like any habit, it takes time to develop. But like any habit, once you do develop it, there's a momentum that goes along with it, and it becomes routine, and it becomes easier. You might want to consider two ways to practice solitude. The first would be to create this space at regular intervals throughout your day. Listen to what the psalmist wrote. Evening, morning, and noon, I cry out in distress, and he hears my voice. So what if you just took a few moments, 5 moments, let's just say, 5 minutes, evening, morning, and afternoon, and took 5 minutes and cried out to God. Just spent 5 minutes with him. Another way to practice solitude is to set aside longer periods to be alone. Maybe once a month, you create a space for just a half day. Maybe once a year, you find a full day. Some people even find a whole weekend. Let me close with this great quote from Francis de Sales about this. He said, "There's no clock, no matter how good it may be, that doesn't need resetting and rewinding twice a day." Now, this is, you know, back before the clocks we have, right? He didn't have Apple Watches, right? Okay. Once in the morning and once in the evening. In addition, at least once a year, it must be taken apart to remove the dirt clogging it, straighten out bent parts, and repair those worn out. In like manner, every morning and evening, a man or woman who really takes care of his heart must rewind it for God's service. Moreover, he must often reflect on his condition in order to reform and improve it. Finally, at least once a year, he must take it apart and examine every piece in detail, that is every affection and passion, in order to repair whatever defects there may be. Let's pray together. As we have our heads bowed and eyes closed for a few moments, I want us to just actually take a few moments here. I know that it's kind of awkward sometimes to do that in church, to just be quiet. But I just want to give you the opportunity right now to just spend a moment or two in silence and in solitude. See if you can sort of like nudge your soul to come out and connect with God for a moment. We're going to just play a little beautiful cello music just to give you an opportunity to do that. And then I'll reconnect with you in just a moment. Feel free if you'd like to open your eyes. That works better for you. That's fine too. There's no one way to do this. Father, we thank you that with very large gestures, as large as Jesus spread out his arms on the cross, that you invite us into your presence. Teach us, Lord, to be alone with you. Teach us to find space within our hearts, within this physical world, space for you. As we transition, I'd like us to spend a few moments in worship. One of the things that we realize in solitude is how much we need the Lord. And so CJ is going to lead us in a song where we're able to express how much we need him. So let's worship together. CJ?